At Grainger, we're for the ones who specialize in saving the day and for the ones who've mastered the art of keeping business moving. We offer industrial-grade supplies for every industry with same-day pickup and next-day delivery on most orders, all backed by real people ready to help. So you can get the right answers and products right when you need them. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And yes, I've been traveling, I've been out and about, out of Colombia, back to Colombia, up to Mompos, back to Bogota, and yes, up to Philadelphia, Caldas as well. But you'll hear more about that at another time, where I'm going. I've been invited to an Encuentro de Escritores, which they've been doing for something like 20-odd years up there in Philadelphia, Caldas. But again, I will talk about that and wax lyrical about that at another time on this podcast. But this is episode 185. Can you believe it? 185, only 15 episodes short of the big 200. And we have another very special guest on the show. He's on the line from Sheffield in England, of course. And his name's Pete Watson, who has a history in Colombia, which I didn't know about, but we've been conversing on Twitter over I guess, a little while now. But he's got vested interests in football, in the national sport here in Colombia, in football, and of course in Colombia. So we're going to be talking to him about his various interests. So Pete, welcome on episode 185 of Colombia Calling.
Thanks very much, Richard. Thanks very much for inviting me on the show. It's a pleasure to speak to you.
Yeah, so, it is a pleasure. You know, seeing you across the computer here, I've put a face to the name and of course now face to the tweets, because you would tweet about football and you'd tweet about politics, and of course this caught my eye. And then you shared your master's thesis with me, which is about football. And well, let's start off with the very basics. From where does your interest in Colombia come from?
I was kind of taken there. My family moved to Colombia, to Cali, when I was 12 years old. My father was a headmaster in kind of British schools, and we moved to Cali. And it was a bit of a shaky introduction to the country, as we arrived 3 days after Galan had been assassinated. So I remember arriving at Cali in the night and seeing kind of the aftermath of various riots and protests and stuff like that. But it was fantastic after that, really. We lived in Colombia and Cali for 4 years. I was at school there for 3 of those years before going back to Britain to do my GCSEs. And so that basically gave me my kind of future career, really. That's where I learned Spanish. That kind of led to pretty much everything I've done since.
Well, yeah, and so I've seen that you study Hispanic studies. You've taught at various boarding schools in the UK, and now you're well on your way to becoming an academic, and your studies are following that, you know, the work of, let's say, President Santos and football, how they sort of he has blended football, I guess, in his terminology, and indeed in the investment towards the sport. Would you say so?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely it. I mean, I basically, after I'd taught for 15 years, as you said, I kind of decided that I wanted to go back to researching things that I was passionate about. And, you know, this was a chance really to get back on to learning more about Colombia, something I'd always read about and always tried to keep in touch with what was going on. And so, you know, I did a few modules on Mexico and Argentinian literature. And then luckily enough, I managed to get a chance to do a module about football in South America, and I found very quickly that Colombian football hadn't really been researched at all. So I kind of plunged in, and I wrote my dissertation about 3 periods of Colombian football. But what I've kind of moved on to doing now is very much, as you say, looking at how President Santos really kind of you know, any opportunity he gets, whenever there's any football success, I mean, whenever there's any sporting success, he's very quick to talk about what a great moment this is for Colombia. But also he kind of adds about what Colombians can learn from the football team. And also, particularly, you know, in the run-up to the election in 2014, and certainly in all the negotiations with FARC, there was a lot of comment, a lot of statements, a lot of press releases, a lot of tweets, just saying, you know, this is what football can bring for Colombia as well. This can get us to peace. So yeah, so I'm really kind of looking at what he's doing without looking at the details in terms of his speeches, also looking at the policies that he's introduced. And you know how these kind of policies are taking hold and how they're being received by Colombians.
I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, a lot of people wouldn't relate football, let's say this mass sport, with the politics of a country, because this is South America, and as you well know, the country stops regardless of how badly La Selección, the Cafeteros, are playing. How, you know, they could be in the pits, but the country stops for every single game. I've mentioned it before on this show, but I mean, people are allowed to go to work in their shirts. Doesn't have the stigma of the sort of St. George's cross, you know, putting it in your car or putting it in a window. It's truly a uniting theme here.
I think that was one of the first things I noticed when I got to Colombia back in 1989. I remember that the qualification for the 1990 World Cup was going on, and our school completely stopped when Colombia played their last qualifying match. And even more amazingly, when I think it was Ecuador playing Paraguay, Colombia weren't even involved, but if Ecuador won, then Colombia would go through. And the whole school stopped all their lessons. We were watching this match. Everyone went absolutely nuts when the match was over. So I think that really showed, I was thinking, why are we watching an Ecuador-Paraguay game? So that, I mean, that really hit me hard. But I think in terms of just how important it is to the country, I mean, there was a survey in 2013-2014 where called the Poder del Fútbol, the Power of Football survey, and it showed that 94% of the population, or of the population interviewed anyway, thought that football was either important or very important. And I mean, if you think about this in a country which unfortunately has got so many kind of historic divisions, there's been a lot of regional problems, of political problems, of, you know, of different city problems and so on. If something can unite Colombians as well as football can, that's quite a remarkable thing. And I think it's not just in Colombia, as you say. I mean, there's a long history in South America, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Uruguay, that whenever there is a really significant football triumph, it becomes a really big deal for the nation. You know, a nation which maybe doesn't hit the international stage regularly, maybe doesn't get the best press. But when, for example, Uruguay won the World Cup in 1930, this was suddenly, you know, Uruguay hitting the global stage, a kind of unheard of nation. And I think it's the same for Colombia. I think that whenever Colombia has a triumph, whenever they, you know, they do well in the World Cup, when James Rodriguez plays well, whenever they show well in the sporting field, this is a chance to say, look, this is what Colombia can be. This is what this country has as a potential. And there's a lot of political power that you can get from something that so many people are very passionate about.
And that's it, isn't it? The political power, the clout, not just economic, but political, of course. And the regions that develop the players. I mean, it's all over, but I will just a quick anecdote, of course, of when I was recently down in the FARC transition camp. It was a Sunday, and what were they doing? They had a mini tournament. I mean, everybody was playing football, so even the guerrillas. But we know that the guerrillas, it's their favourite thing. And that's why so many guerrillas got caught during Colombia games, because they were putting up the satellites to watch the games. I mean, it's always one of those things that there used to be additional sort of flyovers in guerrilla zones so that they would capture, the government could capture guerrilla leaders. And indeed, of course, if you think about it, that's when they pamphlet as well. They pamphleted the jungle during guerrilla games, and also in the radio and on the radio when they're broadcasting games, and on the TV. There's all that publicity, isn't there? There's all that advertising. Guerrilla demobilize. Guerrilla demobilize.
I mean, that was something I talked about quite a lot, actually. That advert. I thought it was a really fascinating way where you have, you know, people from all over Colombia, from Chocó, from the Caribbean, police, former footballers, all kind of sitting, you know, with a seat empty beside them, patting on the seat, saying, come on, guerrilla, demobilise. But I think, I mean, as well, there's a really interesting book. I think it was by Ricardo Henao Calderon, I think it was, who wrote about the experiences of various hostages who spent time under FARC imprisonment in the jungle, and how they managed to try and keep their fandom going, you know, by listening to the radio, by enjoying these matches. And I think a few of them talked about how it was one way of kind of creating relationships with the FARC guerrillas by talking about them and how Santa Fe had done, how Junior got on at the weekend, how Nacional were going to play, you know. So I think, yeah, I mean, you can see just what a passion it is across, you know, every sector of society.
I find it so fascinating as well. Even you know, now, I guess, I know we've gone through the peace accords with the FARC. Of course, there's much to do, but we've got, of course, the ELN on the table as well, if that stays there on the table. But I imagine that that advertising, that sort of campaigning will continue. Well, will continue to the banner across the base of the game when you're watching it, usually blocking the image, you know, when they're at a corner or something, you know, but probably at one of the most tense moments. It's like, guerrilla desmovilize. And you're like, oh, for the love of God, you know.
I remember that, actually, those kind of annoying adverts, you know. I mean, that was another thing. Because I learned Spanish, really, from watching football games and listening to them on the radio. That was how I kind of, you know, because I could see the game, I could see what was going on, and you'd hear the kind of tiro de esquina kind of jingle and all the various adverts that were going on incessantly. But I think you know, with FARC particularly, you know, they've very much tried to use football as well to kind of publicize themselves as being part of the nation. I think one of their biggest problems, as I see it anyway, is trying to say, look, we are also Colombian citizens, we live here as well, we are part of the nation, we want to be part of a nation as it moves forward. So when you see them, for example, some of the negotiators in Havana, when that was going on, the World Cup was going on, and you see Ivan Marquez, for example, wearing a Colombia football shirt and showing their support for the nation as well. I mean, that's a very powerful statement, you know, if a national team is even appealing to guerrillas who are supposedly fighting against the government. But also, I mean, there was even reports that they might even have a football team themselves in La Paz, I think it was. There was a kind of report in El Espectador a couple of weeks ago about how the FARC might even have, you know, a football team, for example. And again, they've very much, you know, made football something to kind of create more of a link with the Colombian people. I know that a kind of an America Nacional combined team played in La Elvira in, I think it was mid-February. Valderrama and Mauricio Chicho Serna, two of the great kind of heroes of that kind of great Colombian generation of the 1980s and early 1990s. They kind of organised a match to celebrate peace that Diego Maradona played in as well. So I think FARC also see football as one way that they can kind of legitimise themselves in the eyes of many, really.
I think you're right. I think that piece in El Espectador that you mentioned, I read it. Are they going to call themselves like La Paz FC or something along those lines?
I don't know if it's going to happen, but you know, that's certainly a plan anyway.
It certainly would make them targets too. You have to be careful about these things. But I mean, it would be fascinating, and it is a unifying theme. It is a bridge between, let's say, the legitimate and maybe, if you say, in inverted commas, illegitimate sort of society that's out there. But I mean, every town in Colombia, every little place has, you know, a football field in it. I mean, that's the thing. And of course, not only is football a uniting theme, but of course, it's been the dividing theme. When, for example, when I was back here in 1998, when I was traveling around the Pacific coast, I wanted to give footballs to local kids in the middle of nowhere. And they were like, no, you can't give footballs because the guerrilla put explosives in it. I mean, that's pretty terrifying stuff. So it had both sides to it, doesn't it?
That's absolutely right. I think it's nice as well how you, I mean, there's been a couple of films, Colombian films, where they've had football in. I think it was called Pena Maxima. I haven't actually seen the film. It's one I'd love to see. So if any of your listeners know about how I can get a copy of it, that would be great. But I think there was a film where they showed, I think it was the army and the FARC coming together to watch a key football match. There's another film called Colores de la Montaña, I believe, where a couple of boys are kicking around a football and it goes into a ground that has been mined. So again, you know, you see how such an innocent game in such a kind of quiet, beautiful part of the countryside, suddenly it gets, you know, the conflict kind of reaches out there as well. So there's a lot of you know, there's a lot of symbolism in that as well, I think.
I think it's fascinating stuff indeed. And so we're going to take a short break, though, where we're talking to Pete Watson, who's in Sheffield in the United Kingdom. If you want to get in touch with him and with any possible tips or, of course, how he can get his hands on one of those films, you can get him on his Twitter handle. That's at Pedro El Profesor. So in all Spanish there, at Pedro El Profesor. So that's Pete Watson, who's currently pursuing a PhD at the moment at Sheffield. And we're very happy to have him on the line at the moment. But we're going to take a short break. This is Columbia Calling, episode 185. I'm Richard McCall. Please don't go away. Back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,500 meters closer to the stars. We're talking to Pete Watson in Sheffield, the United Kingdom. We're talking about, well, he's basically an expert on Colombian football and Colombian politics, really. I mean, that's what we're talking about. And let's say the metaphors that football can have in a country that's been in conflict since, well, some people say 64, some people say 53. You know, basically the conflict has run and run. I mean, it's been a sorry state of affairs here in Colombia. And, of course, the sporting world in Colombia has been affected on account of this. But we've been talking to Pete about his background in Colombia and, of course, his interests in Colombia. And I want to talk right now, Pete, about your thesis, your master's thesis, which, of course, you will be delving into further, in further depth for your PhD dissertation. But if I've got it right, the title of your master's thesis is Un País en una Cancha, Professional Football Clubs and la Selección in the Development of a Colombianidad. Start first for some of my listeners out there who probably won't really understand what is the essential basis of Colombianidad. Let's start with that.
Okay, I guess that what I was looking for was, what I was trying to do with the masters and carrying on now really is looking at how football has contributed to nation building, how football kind of helps to unify a nation, how it kind of helps to add to a national identity. Because I think through, you know, certain kind of representations, whether it's famous, for example, figures or teams or even armies and so on, a nation is kind of created and a nation becomes stronger. So I really wanted to look at how football was used to kind of help bring the nation together, to create a greater sense of togetherness across the country. And that was why I kind of chose the Un País en una Cancha. And just to give you a bit of background on that, that was used as a kind of Twitter hashtag during the World Cup. And I thought that was very interesting, the fact they were saying one country on one field. Because I think a lot of the time, and a lot of historians, a lot of political analysts who talk about Colombia, say that, you know, it's not really ever become a nation, it's still developing, that disunity has been more of a factor than unity. So that was where that came from, really. And as you see, as you said, I chose three key periods where Colombian football was very successful. And the first one was in 1948 through to 1953. And that kind of era has a kind of particular importance in Colombia's history, because it was after the assassination of Jorge Eliezer Gaitán, which led to the Bogotazo, which led to a period that's commonly known as La Violencia. But what people don't really know that happened very, very soon afterwards, that the first Colombian National Professional League started. And Colombian football before that had been very kind of piecemeal. There were really regional tournaments in Antioquia and Bogotá on the coast and so on, but there hadn't really been an organised league. And so the league was really rushed into operation. It had been kind of mooted before the assassination of Gaitán, but it kind of hurried it up, really, as the politicians saw this as a way of pacifying the kind of angry masses in the cities. So suddenly you have teams in Bogotá, in Barranquilla, in Cali, in Medellín, all competing on a national level in a tournament. And this creates a huge amount of interest in Colombia, seeing clubs from all over the country they'd never really seen before. And then what you also get is a huge amount of foreign players coming in, which is absolutely fascinating. I mean, now we talk with the English Premier League about how it's dominated by foreigners and so on, but this happened in Colombia in the late 1940s. At one point, you know, there were far more foreign players playing than Colombians, and some of the greatest Latin American players of that generation, from Pedernera, from Alfredo Di Stéfano, Néstor Rossi, were all playing in Colombia. So this became really much, you know, a kind of focal point for world football, particularly when you have some English footballers as well, even playing in this league. So anyway, so I picked that period of time to see how football was used to help with trying to create a greater sense or whether it was used as a greater sense of building a nation. But I see really at that point, football really just being a kind of opium of the masses, a way of entertaining the crowds in the cities, rather than it trying to become something that really united everyone. It's more of an entertainment than anything else. So I started with that period, and then I looked at the kind of period from 85 to 94, where Colombia qualified for World Cups in 1990 and 94, kind of one of the great generations of Colombian footballers with Valderrama and Tino Asprilla, you know, those kind of figures. And again, that was a very interesting political time in Colombia's history, with the issues with FARC and the paramilitaries, but also the kind of fight with the drug cartels. And it's very similar. Football almost becomes a way of saying, let's try and get together, let's through football try and build something much more positive that Colombia can be known for. So I certainly know that when I went to Colombia, and very sadly what a lot of my friends said when I went out there is, oh, that's where all the drugs come from, that's where all the bombs were. But the football team tried to become a way of presenting something different, of a team that had flair, had passion, had talent, and that could show the best of Colombia. And unfortunately, you know, as I discussed, you know, that didn't really work. And then the last period we've already mentioned a little bit is the current period under Santos. So they were the three periods I focused on.
No, but very, very key periods, and because there's some wilderness years lost in there too. And let's start with 1948 to 53. So prior to that, of course, you had Jack Greenwell out here starting as a man from Crooktown, County Durham. Someone who actually lives in the house in which he was born was on the show many months ago, Harold Stevenson. So thank you to Harold. And they've got a plaque up for him now in Crooktown after campaigning the local MP. They've got him up there, but he's not known here in Bogota. But I haven't been able to find his tombstone because he was buried in just an unnamed grave in the British cemetery. But at the same time, you know, there's that element, and I think there's that side of things where, even dating back to independence and then that sort of area, whether you've got the English, let's say, foreign legion or mercenaries, some might call them, fighting with Bolivar, you know, the let's say those who've been let go after the Napoleonic Wars, there was always that look towards England as a, let's say, seat of learning and culture. And even, I mean, we can bring football into that too. So therefore the football from the UK was looked at. You've got Jack Greenwell. He starts out as really putting Santa Fe together. And of course they're molded. Their team strip is molded on Arsenal for their sins. And if you're an Arsenal fan out there, I'm sorry. I just had to say it. But equally so, you've got that, and then you're talking about the 1950s, and you've got I guess they refer to as, aren't they, the Bogota Bandits, because they essentially cut themselves off from being able to play in England again, but having been tempted out to play in Colombia with so much money in the day. I mean, what one of them called Charlie Mitten, is that right? From
And there was Neil Franklin as well, is another one. Yeah,
and they came from, I mean, proper, let's say, working class clubs like Stoke and I can't remember where else. I mean, I've read something.
I think Charlie Mitten was from Man United.
Okay.
And if I remember right, there was a Scottish player from Hearts, and I think someone from Everton. I think that might be right.
That sounds right.
Four of them that certainly were there.
But I mean, amazing to think, because this is not a globalized world we're talking about back in the day. I mean, that's, you're going into the far unknown, which is what I like about that story. And then, of course, you've got Di Stéfano, like you said, and talking about that. And as you say, it's like an opium for the masses. But it must go some way into enforcing that sort of those regional divisions that we see today in Colombia, because the country's divided into 6 to 8 to 12 different countries. And while football might unite, it might be the great divider too.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that you've always got the problem that for example, when a national team play, the kind of whole national team kind of come together and celebrate it. But if the only football that is really being played is very much a regional one, then, you know, the city teams of Bogota, the city teams of Medellin become the kind of the emblem of that particular region. Mm. And it's kind of like saying, oh, great, look how the coastal team is doing better than the city team. This is a mark of how we're better than them and so on. Yeah. But I mean, it was always such a problem. I mean, from the very start, the way Colombian football was introduced to Colombia was very much a piecemeal thing because of all the geographical problems that you had. Some football starting in Barranquilla, and Barranquilla's of Austin claim that football started there. Santa Marta also claim it started there. Even Pasto claims it started there. I mean, what's really interesting, though, apparently, is that it's actually said to have been introduced by an American colonel called Henry Roan Lemley, who apparently introduced it in the Escuela Militar in Bogota in 1892. So that's actually seen as when it was first officially played, and there were some rules published in a newspaper in Bogota at the time to kind of as proof of that. But because the football was being played in all these different places and it wasn't really uniting, Colombia as a national team or Colombian football as such didn't really develop together. It was developing all in random bits. Whereas, for example, in Argentina, where football was in Buenos Aires and really was dominant in Buenos Aires, everyone was playing in Buenos Aires. They were there the whole time. There was much more competition, and the Argentinian team emerged from there kind of a lot more strong. So it kind of explains why in places where, for example, like Uruguay with Montevideo, Buenos Aires, and maybe in Rio and Sao Paulo, why those three nations' football developed much more quickly when Colombia was so very separate and so very, you know, broken up, as you say, into very different regions with different identities and different styles developing.
I can definitely see that. And of course, when you think of Buenos Aires, of course, and greater Buenos Aires and all the teams, and then you think, look at Uruguay, for example, and there's no difficulty in traveling around that country. And you're talking about the distances, and there's no real geographical hindrances there. And of course, the absolute density of the population, Sao Paulo, Rio, of course, it makes a big difference when you're looking at the differences between Cali, Medellin, Bogota, Barranquilla. I mean, these are different countries altogether. But I like the reference to Santa Marta because Union Magdalena there wasn't it completely filled by Hungarians fleeing the Soviet invasion at one point?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's fascinating. I think they played for San Marios. They formed a team and were part of that league. And this wasn't alone. I mean, pretty much what happened was that Millonarios were the first team to really see the potential of strikes in Argentina, player strikes. And they went and bought Adolfo Pedernera, who was a huge hero, probably starting to come to the end of his career in Argentina. But he arrived. Everyone in Bogota pretty much turned up to see him because he was so well known. And he was the very first. And then suddenly in Millonarios, you have a team with 10 Argentinians. In Cali, in Deportivo Cali, there was a team full of Peruvians. In Cúcuta, they had Uruguayans. Again, you talked about the Hungarians playing in Santa Marta, and every kind of team in those early leagues of what was called El Dorado, the kind of Golden League, really specialized in having their own kind of team of foreigners. And at one point, I mean, the whole Paraguay and the whole Peruvian teams were playing in the Colombian League. And Colombia at this time, you know, this was a nation that was a failure as a football nation. They'd never won anything. They were not nowhere near the level of, for example, Uruguay, Brazil, or, you know, Argentina, nowhere close. So suddenly having these Galacticos of the day from the continent was an absolutely massive deal for the country.
It's just fascinating. It's fascinating when you think of how it unravels when you put it together. But let's move forward to the 85-94, which again is the golden generation, and the generation that defeated, the Selección defeated Argentina away. Was it 5-0? Was it 5-0? I mean, you know, and they still hark back to this. There's still clips of this all the time on TV here, and you're like, think it's time to move on. But I guess it's the same as in the UK, well, in England, the Jeff Hurst skull in 66, the one that may or may not have crossed the line. Thank you, Russian linesman. Aside from that, it's really interesting to see that. But 85, 94 sort of harks a different, it's a different era, isn't it? It's a different era altogether. There's a different Colombia at play. The violence is heavy. Kidnapping is way up. Money laundering is really taking over as well. And the sort of mafia involvement in local and I would say the national side. And it's kind of capped off with that. The Pelé saying that the Colombian team are the dark horses for the US World Cup there in Pasadena and Los Angeles, and then not getting through that first round. And of course, then the tragic death, murder of Andres Escobar, the captain, there in the car park in Medellin. I mean, you must have some thoughts about this.
Yeah, I think, I mean, what made that generation so important for Colombia in the first place? It really was the first time that the Colombian football team had made it on the national stage. I mean, we talked about that the El Dorado League was famous because of all the other players from other nationalities. It wasn't Colombia. But the 1985 team that started with a junior side and then these players start filtering through, it actually was a Colombian team, and it was a Colombian team that had a certain style where you can say, oh, look how we're playing. This is something that's different. This is not us trying to copy Argentina. This is a Colombian style. And I think that certainly the coach that was extremely well known and responsible for this, Francisco Maturana, just made it clear what a big deal this was. You know, he talks about the hard-working players from Antioquia combining with the flair of the coastal players and the charisma and imagination of the Cauca players. And this is what they talked about. They said, look, we're taking these elements from the country and we're making it into something that is truly Colombian, parts of the country uniting to finally create a great football team. The problem, of course, with this is that when you have this success and you talk about the 5-0 victory, which was such a massive deal, but the fact that they were qualifying for the World Cup for the first time since 1962 and winning games against big teams, the problem with all this is that, as you say, a lot of it is based on potentially drug money, on the fact that these teams, Nacional, América de Cali, Millonarios, are all kind of said to have been sponsored, if you like, to have been funded by some of the leading cartels. And indeed, some of the authors have written about this period, say it was almost like the football matches were a battle of a cartel versus cartel, and that was part of the problem. So when President Gaviria, who was the president for the 1994 World Cup, was talking about after the 5-0 victory against Argentina, he was saying, look, this is a new start for Colombia. This is a turning point in our history. This is a point where the violence has gone back and we can all unite and we're showing a Colombia that can win and can play brilliantly, and these are our ambassadors for the country. So he was saying all this. But unfortunately, when as was revealed, a lot of the football players had some links with cartels, the rumours of them visiting, for example, Pablo Escobar when he was in La Catedral jail. I mean, René Higuita was seen on television and interviewed before he went in. And when it was revealed that, you know, a lot of the money that was going into the clubs came from the drug cartels and these players had come from these clubs, it was almost like, again, it was almost representing a corrupt Colombia again, which was very problematic. So Gabriel is saying, oh, look, these are our ambassadors of the nation, what heroes they are. But they came from clubs, and some of them even had links, even if it was unwillingly. It didn't look good for Colombian football. And the tragic death of Andres Escobar, you know, when he was shot afterwards, you know, after such a terrible time in the World Cup. And I mean, the game in America, there's lots of talk about how before the game there were death threats made to Francisco Maturana and Gabriel Barabas Gomez, one of the midfielders in that team. You know, there'd been threats. It's really no wonder when you hear what might have gone on, it's no wonder how they struggled so much. And it was such a tragedy, really, that a team had so much talent and so much potential and, you know, seemed to maybe offer a sense of a, you know, happiness for a country that had been struggling so much, how that kind of just ended in tragedy with Escobar's death again. That was a really sad moment for the country, I think.
Yeah, and I think you could say that Colombia lost its joy for the game in that sort of circumstance. I think about Colombia and Colombian football, and then we think about the politics. And of course, Gaviria not averse there to using the opium for the masses for his own political gain. And Santos is, he's a Teflon president as well. He'll do whatever needs to be done to ensure that he gets the ratings, which are really low at the moment. So I think it's very interesting that I'm sure he'll be backing the team very strongly in coming months for when we're back in the World Cup qualifying rounds again. It looks like Colombia, well, I don't want to jinx it, I'm going to go through. It'll be a point here or there, but I think it looks like they'll go through. This new generation with James Rodriguez and this new guy Marlos, I think he looks pretty good. What are your thoughts towards the team at this moment?
I think that they're a team I enjoy watching. I think that the team that is playing at the moment is a very different Colombian team. They feel a lot more professional, a lot more worldly wise than for example the team in the 80s and 90s. A lot of them have played abroad, and I think certainly the 2014 generation really showed the country in a great stead. You had the dancing from the very first goal that Pablo Armero scored. The fans were fantastic. You had this kind of Mancha Amarilla, everyone wearing yellow, face painting, the condors on the ground. And I think that was a very important tournament for Colombia because it kind of was almost a fulfillment in a way. It was like, right, I know they only got to the quarterfinals, but it was a real success for them. It left a really positive image of the nation. I think at the moment, really, from what I can see, that they really benefit a lot from a lot of them having played abroad. There's a kind of a growing sense of maturity, a tactical awareness. Whether they can say that typical Colombian style is still being played, I don't know. But it's certainly great to see, the likes of James Rodriguez in full flight. I think, all they just have to do is work out what the best forward line is at the moment. The goal scoring seems to be a bit of a problem. Yeah. But I think an important football generally has a very important role to play. And maybe I think that a lot of the footballers maybe have been a little bit reluctant to say things, particularly regarding the peace process and the political issues, because it's not a kind of way of putting your head above the parapet. I think that's often been a dangerous thing to do. But I think that potentially with a lot of them, talking about how peace is important for the country, and actually the old generation of footballers, the 1990 generation, a lot of them have been involved in peace games, and there was a government campaign called Me la juego por los víctimas, I play for the victims, which visited various towns and cities and regions that had been quite problematic, and Carlos Valderrama and Chicho Serna and various others went to these towns. They played football matches, they had kind of coexistence meetings, they talked about the type of services that were available for the victims. And I think that it's things like that in which footballers past and present can actually have a really important role that doesn't necessarily have to be a political role, but as a kind of more of an exemplary role for bringing people together and passing on good practice and so on. So I think that's going to be very important for this generation of footballers, and hopefully I think we'll see that carrying on in the 2018 World Cup if they make it.
God, we hope so. And so interesting to think of it along these lines. Now I have one question, or one, let's say, statement, maybe not a question, but that came up in that last chat that we just had, that last sort of conversation when we were talking about sort of the corruption and the money laundering that was going through cartel versus cartel. If we were to take that today, let's say that the cartels pumping all of this money into America de Cali, Millonarios, was it Gacha who loved Millonarios and so on, is there a big difference to that with today's Russian oligarchs from their different, their varying, let's say, doubtful income from various dubious means? Is there a big difference between the two things, would you say?
It's a very big problem, isn't it? I think that's where there's a lot of a lack of knowledge, I suppose. And I think that a lot of people have always taken the money first and not asked questions at the time. I think that the desire for football success, for your club to do well, and the fact that suddenly all this money comes in and suddenly you can buy these great players. And I think it's a very interesting point. I mean, there isn't a huge amount of investigation and maybe due diligence in some of the oligarchs that have taken over a lot of clubs in particularly Britain. You look at some of the clubs in Italy as well that have had these links. And you can understand why it happens, you know. And I think that you look at just how, I mean, Pablo Escobar, for example, there are all these stories about him putting in football pitches and putting in lighting. And I think Leonel Alvarez and maybe Chonto Herrera, two of the players in that generation, talked about how, you know, he gave them somewhere to play. They owed him their careers. And, you know, in some ways, you know, you can see that as being a good thing. You know, suddenly money has gone into social areas. The government has kind of ignored infrastructure, has not spent the money on football-related projects like they should have done. So yeah, there's not a huge amount of difference. It's quite a troubling issue. And I think the one thing that you do hope is that, and that you do worry about, is that a game that's so beloved of the people, you know, the masses, the poor people in throughout the country, that shouldn't be ruined or corrupted by, you know, people who've got something a lot shadier to hide. And you hope that in Colombia, at least, you know, you hope that that's not happening anymore.
Well, we can but hope, and fascinating, but really interesting when we put it into sort of today's circumstances. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you and to think about politics and football in particular in Colombia. I know this will have been thought provoking to my listeners out there. I'm going to do a shout out for you. You're coming out in August. Hopefully, you're coming out in August this year, and you're going to be doing some research for your PhD. So anyone who's connected to football or I think social work surrounding football and so on and so forth, if they are listening to this or anyone knows of anyone, then perhaps get in touch with that. Well, either drop us a line on our Facebook page or, of course, columbiacalling@gmail.com, or at Pedro El Profesor, his Twitter, Peter's Twitter handle, because I know that any connections are well received and, you know, of course, incredibly important. And it's a really interesting theme, and sometimes it can be hard to research once in Colombia. Sometimes it can be hard to find the right people, so let's start helping Pete from this moment here on in. Pete, let me take a moment to say thank you so much for your time. I know you're a very busy guy, you've got to get back to the books, and congratulations on your cricket victory today. I know you're teaching the university cricket team there at Sheffield, you're coaching them, so again, thank you for being on Columbia Calling.
No, thank you so much, Richard. And again, thanks very much for mentioning my forthcoming visit. And like I say, you know, I'll be hopefully coming in August, September and October. The idea will be to talk with as many people about football as possible. I love talking about it from a fun aspect, let alone a historical one. But anyone really who's interested in the history of the game in Colombia, or for example, is involved with community projects where football is used, and I'd love to hear from you. It'd be really, really helpful and really fascinating. But yeah, again, Richard, thanks so much. Really enjoyed talking to you. I hope it's been interesting. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
It has been incredibly interesting. We've been talking to Pete Watson, who's doing his PhD in the School of Hispanic Studies there at the University of Sheffield. Yes, if you can help him out, get in touch at Pedro El Profesor, or of course, columbiacalling@gmail.com. Thank you very much for listening. This has been Columbia Calling, episode 185. I've been Richard McCall. We'll be back next week with another interesting interviewee on the line to talk all things Colombia. Thank you again.
This is your moment. Your moment to move forward and make progress. It's time to see where an education can take you. For over 130 years, Strayer University has been at the forefront of change, offering programs that help students like you get ahead and stay ahead, so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by Chef.